Are you looking for a Columbus car dealership built on tradition and trust? Buyers Auto, family-owned since 1897, offers top new and pre-owned vehicles. Visit us or shop online at buyersauto.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
Thanks so much for downloading Man Made. Just a heads up that the following episode contains some strong language, and we do discuss mental health issues. If any of it strikes a chord with you and you want to find mental health support where you live or talk about your feelings, visit the Hub of Hope, www.hubofhope.co.uk, where you can find links to services across the UK.
I grew up with a very, very dominant father who based himself on being a real man. He put that fear factor into everything. I never, ever wanted anyone to love me. They would have to find out the real me, and I didn't know who the real me was. I've come too far in my life and I've been through too much to get to that point where I live in fear again.
If you had an opportunity to say anything to the guy that attacked you, is there anything that you would say? Welcome to another episode of Man Made with me, Pete Wicks. Today we have an absolute icon in the building. It's DJ Fat Tony. He has got a story of resilience, recovery. He's been quite vocal about the fact that he's been 19 years sober, which is amazing. He tells us how he's feeling now, how he's changed from self-loathing to being happy. One of the most interesting, captivating people I've ever met. And as I said, just an absolute icon. So I hope you enjoy it. Yeah, great ep. So we normally start the pod with like a big question, which is pretty kind of vague, but it's open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to know is, what does being a man mean to you?
Ooh, you started it with,
we
might as
well. We go straight in, mate.
That's what being a man means to me,
yeah.
Going straight in.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there's many aspects to, especially as a gay man, there's a lot of differences between the meaning of masculine man and feminine man. There's so many different types of men. For me, I think being a man is, it's none of that stuff. It's just about being true to myself and being like, okay, this is who I am. I do not need to oversell the product as such as okay, my masculinity, I don't need to be forthright with it. Do you know what I mean? Especially when you're in a male on male relationship. I'm married to a man.
Yeah.
So it kind of like, I grew up with a very, very, very dominant father who was a real, who based himself on being a real man.
So it's the stereotypical like man's man type thing.
Fingers like bananas.
Yeah, yeah.
Like 6'3", plumber, from Battersea, like just, this is my house, you'll do what I say house, everything was his. So I grew up in that kind of environment where I was drawn to my mum.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always mummy's boy. So for me to grow up around that and never want to be that, kind of kept me away from it, kind of kept me, okay, that's not who I, what, that was, for me, that was the image of a man I had in my head of like what men are meant to be like, and I never wanted to be like that.
So do you think your dad was a good man?
My dad was an amazing man.
Just a different type, that old school mentality of what a man is, a provider. Like, you've got to be the bloke. You don't show emotion.
Totally that. And also, you know, he come from quite a regimental family.
Yeah.
And when you take all that into consideration, and then he had his own demons, you know.
Yeah.
If he drank scotch, he turned into a monster, you know. All of these factors, you know, for me as a kid, I just thought, especially as a gay child, and there was never any question about my sexuality. And for him to take that on as a man's man, as such as what the ideology of being a man was, it was a lot for him to take. And I just think that from a very young age, I was always a problematic child, to say the least. And, you know, my other two brothers were always in trouble with the police. I was never in trouble with the police, but as my mum always says, you were more hassle than the other two put together.
So your kind of upbringing then, like coming from, you know, being a mummy's boy, having a great relationship with your mum, which I'm the same, like my mum and my nan brought me up, so they're fucking queens as far as I'm concerned. But having a good relationship with your father, but who was an alpha male, should we say. What was... sort of your emotional, was it kind of talked about when you were younger? Like emotions, like how you felt? Did you discuss that sort of stuff with like your family, with your dad, with your mum? Were you always quite open to talking about that stuff? Or
I was always really open about talking about that stuff, but whether it got listened to, it was kind of shut down. My mum was always a good listener.
Yeah.
My mum always knew. My mum's birthday is one day after mine. We're like, you know, this exactly the same kind of like person, because she annoys me more than anyone on the planet, which means I'm so close to her. Do you know what I mean? Whereas with my dad, I could never open up to him. I could never tell him anything because I was always lived in fear.
Mm.
He put that fear factor into everything.
Yeah.
You know, if I come home from school and I'd had a fight with someone, which was probably every day, he would say to me, did you win? And I'd be like, no. And he'd be like, you better go back out and beat them up, otherwise I'm going to hit you. And I'd be like, how's this work? Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was kind of always like that. You know, he kind of was the epitome of the man. He had the flash car. We were the first to have a satellite dish. Well, you name it. It was all like, you know, you weren't allowed to touch his stereo, otherwise you got hit. Oh, it was that's mine. How dare you touch that?
So what was it that kind of drew you more to your mum then? Was it that kind of gentler side of someone listening to you and being able to be yourself maybe more?
I think the connection with my mum was the fact that she understood. There was never a question of who I was or what my sexuality was or any of that stuff.
No judgment.
Never. Yeah. Never, ever, ever. Don't get me wrong. She'd take a shoe off and hit me with it occasionally. But, you know, or like, you know, all of that stuff. But the thing about it was there was a connection. I never had to explain who I was or what I was going through. My mum always stuck up for me. Even when I was like 14 and I was kicked out of school, permanently kicked out of school. They said, like, we don't want him here. He doesn't want to be here. And my mum never told my dad for a year. I used to have to leave the house in the mornings pretend to go to school.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I fucking did, yeah.
Well, your mum covered for that as well?
She covered it. She was like, don't, I can't put up with him. And I was like, so every morning I'd go in the school uniform and go around the corner and change. But like literally went on for a year.
So, I mean, so you grew up in London.
In Battersea, yeah.
In Battersea. You say your sexuality, you kind of knew from when you were really, really young. Was that difficult around that time?
Like, oh, of course.
The world's changed a lot since then, but I mean, has it? Well, yeah.
So, you know, I live in a bubble, so I always think that things get better, but they're not getting better. Yeah. If anything, right now, things are going the opposite way. But growing up then, I was born in 65, so by the time I was 12, we're in the early 70s, you know, it was like, it's like 77, punk era. There was a lot of rebellion going on in London anyway, around that age. But my brother was a skinhead. All the kids, where I lived in Battersea on Lavender Hill on Queenstown Road, it was on an estate, housing estate. And the beauty of it was we all moved in at the same time.
Okay.
So it was never, it hadn't
so
been
it was
there.
Like a fresh estate.
Yeah, it was a brand new estate. Everyone got a house. Everyone was like, oh my God, we got houses. We've gardens. And, you know, and it, so everyone moved in at that point in time. So everyone was like, there was never any like cliques or anything that. Yeah. So we all created this like
the community type thing.
Really was. And we all used to hang out on this thing called the Wall, where we like, it was like a gang. And there was like about 60 people kids that used to hang out there on the grass banks. And so I was always a part of that. But I was never a part of that. Because I knew what I was, and I never ever pretended I didn't. So, you know, you either took me or left me. Because my brother was always hard. My older brother was like a fucking nutter.
Yeah.
You know, no one ever messed with me. Do you know what I mean? And I kind of rode that for some time.
So, I mean, you got into kind of music at 18. Well, it was when you first
16,
started DJing.
16, 17, yeah.
Was that kind of that industry back then?
Mm.
Was it accepting? What was it like to kind of break into? What was it like for you to be part of kind of that back then?
Well, you know, the clubbing was very different then. It was, you know, you had a this area called the West End, which is Soho, which was four streets. That was clubbing. Mm-hmm. That was it. You went to the West End. You know, there was clubs. You didn't have like, you know, the pockets of like Peckham and all the other clubbing areas now. You didn't have that. to go, you know, I used to go to a club called Turn Mills, which was in Clarkham, and it felt like I was going to the country every weekend.
Yeah.
It was so far away. Do you know what I mean? It's up the road. But, yeah, you know, at that point in time, because it wasn't in those streets, clubbing was that you had the gay club, which was heaven.
Yeah.
You had clubs like the Embassy and stuff like that, which were kind of like, you know, that was just off Bond Street. I mean, at the end of the day, they were niche clubs. And it was like, at that point in time, you had gay characters on TV, like Kenny Everett and mm-hmm. stuff like that. It was very slapstick gay, and, you know, you had to conform to that. So you either went to a men-only club like Heaven or Sombrero or those little clubs, or you went mainstream. And I kind of went into the trendier side of things, like the Wag Club and stuff like that, where no one ever questioned my sexuality, but you kind of like, depending on what night of the week it was, you kind of got that air of like, oh, the gays have arrived. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
For me, I was always so in everybody's face. I think no one really had a chance of, because I would rather attack you than you even give me a date. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, completely. I mean, like, for you and the amount of time you have been kind of at the height of what you do, which is a fucking long time, like you're an icon.
110 years.
No, but what I mean by that is like to be like at that fucking level and that successful, such amount of time is such a, I mean, that's an incredible thing. Did you find it a difficult place to be in? I mean, you know, you've been very open about addiction and everything else. That kind of industry is well known for loving excess and tolerating excess. Do you think, is that kind of where everything started for you?
Oh, 100%. That sort of stuff? For, you know, I was drawn to nightclubs. I was drawn to the lights. I was drawn to the noise. I was drawn to the chaos.
Yeah.
Always have been drawn to chaos, you know. And the very first time I went to a nightclub, which was the Embassy, and I just thought, I never want to leave.
Yeah.
This is what I like. And so then it was like, London was a different place. We went out every night of the week.
What is it about the kind of chaos that you're drawn to? And I presume that it's in everything. Is chaos something you just...
This is chaos.
Yeah.
All I've ever known is noise in my head. You know, there's always a million and one voices. There's always somebody shouting, go left instead of right, you know.
So you've always been like that?
Always been like that.
So, I mean, how difficult has that been in terms of, because it's, you know, we talk about mental health and different types of people and how they kind of use coping mechanisms for different things. That kind of level of noise in your head all the time must be really fucking difficult, and especially difficult to be as successful as what you have been as well with all of that going on. So in terms of coping mechanisms, again, you've been really open about addiction and everything else. Is that part of how you coped with that?
I think music had a really big part in
it.
A really, really, really big part, because just like when it made me feel differently. And I think that, you know, I always say this a lot to people, like, you know, most people listen to music. I feel music.
Yeah.
And it calms me. So, you know, and it takes me to a place that is not in here.
So it's like a safe space for you.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And, you know, it's like, so, you know, for instance, I can be on such a level all week if I'm working in different places or flying around the world. As soon as I get home and I put the telly on, I crash. I'm out like a light. I can't watch anything on TV. Yeah. I can't. I like literally. Like, but music kind of is like, for me, that gateway to sort of sanity in so many ways, because it has so many things attached to it, like memories or like so much.
It's kind of like your vehicle for safety then, you know?
Yeah, it's a vehicle for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Because I can use it to make people happy, which is a remarkable thing.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable thing to have walk into a room and read the room and read the magic in that room and think, okay, this is where that needs to go.
How does it make you feel being able to do that?
I love it. I wouldn't change my career or job for anything.
Yeah.
I think that there's been many an up and down within my career in the sense of my own personal doing. You know, anything outside of that, it's just always been amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm just turned 60 and I'm...
You look fucking great, by the way,
thank
bud.
Thank you. And for me, I've never ever been more connected to what I do and love what I do.
Than now?
Yeah, than now.
Why is that then?
Because I'm at ease with who I am.
Okay.
You know, it, I'm now 19 years in recovery. And for me, the last four or five years have been the turning point within who I am. I don't wake up feeling old anymore. I don't wake up feeling tired or useless or any of that stuff or self-loathing. Mm. I wake up and I'm really all right with who I am and where I am. And that's a remarkable place to be.
So, I mean, would you say that you are happy?
Yeah. And you know what? When I go into work and I travel the world and I DJ, don't get me wrong, I suffer with like imposter syndrome, always have done.
Okay.
I will sit at the front of the plane rather than the back, down the back by the bogs like I used to. But I would still think everyone hates me when I get there. But that's for 10 minutes. Mm. That no longer is like for a whole month, because that used to go on all the time. And now I'm in this different place. And I think that just being accepting around who I am and what I do and my behaviors and overcoming those behaviors. Because, you know, I always say that drink and drugs won't kill, are not going to be the thing that kills me. My behaviors will. Behaviors will be the thing that takes me out sometimes, the way I am towards myself, not towards other people. I don't behave disrespect. It's always to myself.
I must say, like, I know a lot of people that know you, and any time, you know, the past week when I've known you've been coming on here, any time I mention him, everyone goes, I fucking love him.
Mm.
I fucking love
him. That's amazing.
I haven't ever met anyone that's got a bad word to say about you, which just goes to show how well you treat other people. But why have you never been in a place where you've treated yourself like that until necessarily the last 4 years? Is there anything?
It's a learned behaviour. And you know, without sitting here like trying to promote my book, I've got a new book coming out in June, which is called Recover Me. And it's about... it was going to be called Have You Met Me? Because it's like about, yeah, most people, when you meet me, it's like you can say what you want. And then suddenly when you meet me, you'll realize I'm not what you think I am.
Yeah.
It's all about learned behavior. So when we're born, we learn to make a noise to be held.
Yeah.
We learn to make a noise to be picked up and cuddled. And then that noise suddenly... we learn to make another noise, which means we want to be fed. And then that suddenly becomes, as we get older, I want, I need. And then they're all learned behaviors. Mm. And we carry that stuff through life. So suddenly when you bring in trauma or you bring in disconnect or rejection, we learn these coping mechanisms of how we get what we want. So yeah. We scream and we cry, which is why most kids do tantrums. That's yeah. what, because they get to that point. At some point, you're going to get what you want. And we carry those tantrums all the way through till we're 50. We can't, you know, without, because they always work. So if we're in a situation where we lie to get out of it, we will continue lying because it works.
Yeah.
So anything that works for us, we use as
well, it's human nature, isn't
it? Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you get to this point in your life where you've been through so many different things and so many ups and downs and can never work out why. And it's because you're literally running on learned behavior.
Mm.
And suddenly when you sit down and you think, okay, we put down drink and drugs, right? And we move into recovery and nothing changes. And there's no change without change, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you work on that stuff and you just think, hang on, why am I still doing that? Why am I still... I can walk into a room with a gaggle of gays and I have to be the bitchiest, the loudest. I have to insult everyone in the room and then I leave and I think, yeah, you won. That's how it used to be.
Mm.
You know, it's like for years when I used to DJ after getting sober, I still gurned. I still gurn now when I'm tired because it's that neuropath in my brain that kind of like relates. Okay, DJing means your jaw should swing. Because I did it for years. Do you get what I'm saying to you? Yeah. So it still does that when I'm tired. I still find myself lying when I'm tired. Like, oh, are you all right? Yeah, I'm good.
It's like programmed in you.
It really is. And it's about lying about the most stupidest things. Like, have you eaten today? Yeah, loads. And it's like, you know for what you know.
Yeah.
Just little things like that.
It's mad, isn't it? Because, you know, you a couple of minutes ago said that you're happy and people, it's very easy for someone with kind of your background who has been in recovery for 19 years sober to say, well, it all changed 19 years ago. But actually, learned behaviours have continued.
They really do.
And you've said, last 4 years, you've kind of felt different about yourself. You know, that's 15 years of being sober, but still kind of feeling the same. So it's not all down to, you know, excess and drugs and everything.
No, of course. There's a difference between being in recovery, right, yeah, and being recovering and that and being sober. Being okay. sober and putting down a drink and drug is a remarkable thing.
Mm.
Anyone that does it, well done. It's incredible. But just, you know, as I explain to people, when you take the alcohol out of fruitcake at Christmas, what are you left with? Mm. Fruitcake. Right? So unless that stuff's treated, that stuff's always going to progressively get worse. And you really need to just like start thinking, okay, why am I still acting this way? You know, people used to say it all the time. It's like, oh, he's sober. He's still a cunt. and you know what? And it was true. It was really true. But I wasn't so cunty to other people. I was a cunty to myself.
Mm.
Because I always would do these things like, I was so lost at 12 years in recovery with sex addiction. I never ever opened my mouth about sex addiction because I was a gay man. This is what I do. I'm not giving that up. I've given everything else up.
Mm.
Don't smoke anymore. So let me sleep with 8 guys a day. And all that stuff. And it's so destructive and so soul destroying that it leaves you in exactly the same place as booting heroin,
mm,
exactly the same place. It wants you dead. It wants you alone in a room, self-loathing.
What is the kind of feeling that addiction in all sorts of forms, what is it? What is the kind of reasoning behind? Is it a numbing? Does it numb the thoughts?
I think it's a coping mechanism. We use it for different things. I think that I never stood a chance anyway because I come from such a long line of alcoholics.
Yeah.
You know, I had so many fallouts with my family because I was so vocal about it in the past. And my grandfather's an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. Even though I fell out with my dad over the way he treated my mum when I was a kid. And I didn't talk to him for 30 years, right? 30 years. That had nothing to do with him. Even though he was living with my mum and I'd go down there and I'd still blank him in his own house. And it was like, it was like literally, I'd be polite and say, hi, Dad, how are you? Leave it at that. Because I hated him because I could see so much of myself in him and the way I was becoming. And then a situation happened and I was put down my mum and dad's house in Dungeness.
Right? I know like Dungeness.
Yeah, you know that, right? You know how remote it is,
yeah,
right?
It's wild, that place. Yeah, it's insane. Looks like a film set, then beaches at mental, sunset. Yeah, mental.
So I was down there on tag. So I had to be in the house all the time. And I got to know my dad. My dad wasn't the person I thought he was. My dad was 30 years sober. And I never, ever once stopped to ask him if he was. I still carried on acting as if he was still the man that used to beat my mum when he was drunk.
Yeah.
And I held that because I allowed myself to behave like that towards him because it made me feel better. I used to wake up, I still occasionally do, at 2 a.m. in the morning. And by 6 a.m. I want to kill myself because my overthinking, stinking thinking at that time in the morning, I can turn a brown envelope into the biggest catastrophe in the world. Like literally just insanity, it just seeps in because I can lay there and I can just, my mind doesn't shut up. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, what if this? What if that? Oh my God, you're going to go to. Back here, a year ago, I was attacked at work. Yeah. I got sucker punched twice.
So this is in Margate?
Yeah, in Margate.
So, I mean, obviously I've, you know, read articles and whatnot and you've spoken about it previously. What happened?
So basically, I arrived.
Yeah.
In a club called the Lido in Margate, and it was a headline gig. It was Fat Tony at the Lido, so I went on. Anyway, one of the other DJs that was coming on after me, we started having a row. That was it. And I shook his hand and said, "I'm really sorry. You know, listen, no bad thing." So I carried on. Then his mate says something, right, and as I explained before, the background that I have, if someone says something to me, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to give it him back. Do you know what I mean? I don't go violently. I just use, you know, my mouth can be violent enough.
Mm.
And I just said to him, "What did you just call me?" And he called me a faggot. And I was like, "How 1986 are you? Do you know what I mean? Seriously, get out." And that row escalated. Anyway, it was the last track. I went to take my seat and I said, "No hard feelings to the guy." And as I turned around, he sucker punched me twice.
Okay.
Knocked me out, completely out. I woke up in an ambulance. That's how severe it was. And but what I did, what I made, probably one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made in my life, was to post it on social media the next day of like, oh my God, look what happened to me.
Because that victim mode. You documented a lot of the recovery process.
Yeah, the victim mode came straight back in.
Right.
Of like, oh my God, how dare someone do this to me? I've never been punched in my life. Do you get what I mean? Mm. Not to that level. But like, it literally just, I don't know how to cope with it. And of course, the only way I cope with things is by bunging it on the gram. And it was like, so of course, what happens then is, yes, you get the people that are, the honest people that are like, oh my God, this is terrible. And then you get, oh, you deserved it. You were rude to me in 1986. And so it begins. Mm. And suddenly, you know, for all, you know, I don't know who pays for those bots, but those bots exist.
I mean, we talk about kind of, and I've spoken about it a lot on this pod, and certainly when I was younger, I couldn't regulate my emotions. I didn't really know how I felt about stuff, or sad or lonely or whatever else. It always presented itself as anger.
Yeah.
So I used to get in a lot of trouble when I was younger. Do you know what I mean? Having punch-ups and whatnot. But you get older and you learn that that's not the way to deal with things.
Of course.
However, some people don't. Mm. And some people still feel that's the best way to do things. What was it, having documented it online afterwards, and you're saying about that kind of victim mentality, as soon as people start doing that, how did that kind of make you feel? I mean,
it was awful. You know, literally, my face was smashed to pieces. And I then had to go back into hospital and
it was a serious attack. We're not talking about just getting
it broke my eye socket in four places and my cheekbone. It was a vicious attack, let alone all what happened inside my mouth was all ripped open. Like, you know.
Yeah.
But mentally, it scarred me more because I couldn't and didn't want to put myself in that arena straight away for a while. Mm. And of course, you know, when it's on your face, right, everyone knows. And of course, then it went viral and it was on. And then I got sent the video and the video was being passed around. And I, you know, I just thought this needs to be controlled. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, at the time I worked for a publication and I just said, look, you have this because it needs to be dealt with in a proper way because it's going to end up in the wrong hands. Mm. And the situation, anyway, he's just gone to court a couple of months ago and pleaded guilty to grievous bodily harm. And just waiting now for the outcome of that case. But, you know, the thing about it is it took me, it still affects me.
In what way?
Well, I just have to have security when I'm working, which is like, sounds really arsehole-y. Do you know what I mean?
Listen, when you've been through something like that, I think it's fucking
there's certain events that I won't do. There's certain people that I won't play to because I just don't need to be.
You don't need to put yourself in that space.
No, I don't. And you know what? I've come too far in my life and I've been through too much to get to that point where I live in fear again.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm all about happiness and I'm all about trying to create something magical, not the opposite.
I mean, if you had an opportunity to say anything to the guy that attacked you, is there anything that you would say?
I wish him the best in life. I hope he finds recovery. I hope he finds what it is that he needs. Mm. For me, it's like I don't hold resentment against him. It was a situation that happened. And, you know, I never once said his name.
No.
Publicly, online, nothing. I never once got into a conversation or an argument with anyone that knew him because it wasn't who I am. I don't need to do that. And also, I'm not giving anyone a platform.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I really hope that he, you know, he gets what it is that he needs in life in the sense of some calmness because, you know, you can't go around doing that kind of stuff.
And, no, absolutely not.
You know, it's a difficult one because there's a part of me that was like, yeah, let's get him done. And I mean, listen, do you know how many people that came out of the woodwork and said, do you want me to go? I know his address. Yeah. And I was like, No.
But that's the cycle, isn't it? And, you know, I think as a man, and it's not purely based on gender, but I think as a man, it's our ego, the pride, of the same thing. Where, you know, when I was young, it's like, no one's going to get the better of me. And even now, I see it now. Even as silly things, as we're saying, like online, when someone will call me a cunt, I think, I wish I fucking knew where you live, you prick.
Yeah, of course.
But you have to go, no, fuck that. And I think as a man...
I did it yesterday.
Yeah.
I literally did it yesterday. I was like, oh my God, my friend rang me. She's like, have you seen these comments? And I was like... And then I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, like, mate, you know.
Do you think that's something that's instilled in men to be, you know, if we're looking at, because I grew up, you know, again, with a bloke supposed to be a bloke. You don't cry, you don't talk about emotions, you don't say how you feel, you just do something. It's actions.
Yeah.
Do you know
what
I mean? You do something about it. And I still get that now. I still get that thing where I think, I should do something about that. I want to protect everyone, I want to protect myself. And it is, it's ego.
And ego
it's
comes
pride.
From a place of fear. Ego is 100%. Fear-fueled. And I think that when we try to overcome and we overcome those fears of being less than, being how we're being seen as, all of those things, which played a very big part of my life because I was a fat kid. I've gone through many manifestations.
You've been reborn many times.
I really have, you know, and it's like when we go through those different changes within our lives and we find acceptance around the things that other people don't accept. And there's like a certain like, level of, okay, I know who I am. I don't know what I want. Mm. I think that ego depletes. But you know what? Sometimes catch me on the wrong day. And like, you know, I was on a plane the other week and I've just bought a brand new bag. I'm such an arsehole. I bought a brand new Bottega bag and I had it over on top of me, you know, at the front of the plane, which was, and this woman gets on and she shoves my bag down. And I lost. I was like, what are you doing? Excuse me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That bag cost more than this. Yeah, and it started that I was off.
Yeah.
And I reduced her to tears. And I was like, why have I just reduced a woman to tears? And then she started crying because she was drunk. And then, of course, it made me look like I annihilated some woman on the plane.
But is that something that if you'd have done that kind of years ago, you wouldn't have given it a second thought and actually now
I would have carried on the whole flight.
Yeah, but now this is part of...
sit well with me. By the end of the flight, I got off and me and her were best friends. I've invited her to things. And she apologized for shoving my bag. She went, I should never have done it. I'm really sorry. And I was like, you know what? My reaction, because I've been brought up and in a world where I react. I'm a reactor.
Every action has a reaction.
It really
reaction.
Does. Yeah. And you know, I react. And then I think 10 minutes later, what have you just said? Why did you say that? Do you know what I mean? Like Margate, for instance. Why did I have a row with them? I had no reason to row with them.
Yeah.
I was content. You know, it's like, I should, you know, but of course I'm like, rah, rah, like a Rottweiler, you know, if someone says something to me, how dare you say that to me at my headline gig?
Yeah.
You're only warming up. And the ego comes into play. And, you know, I have to look at my part in everything that I do. If I, this morning, for instance, I FaceTimed my husband was at his house, right? We're a very modern family. He was at his house and I FaceTimed him and I was like, oh, I'm just taking really the dog for a walk and getting a coffee. I said, what's wrong with your face? Why are you not reacting how I want you to react? Like, hey, you know, a dog about to get a treat. And he was like, I'm not feeling great. And I said, you know what? I'll speak to you later. And I put the phone down him. And then I got to the coffee shop and I just thought, why did you just do that? It's because he's not giving you
what you want.
Exactly that. Straight away I've gone back to crying and doing a tantrum.
Is it, you know, because you've been so successful over the years as well and everyone knows you, you know, being famous, being part of that kind of whole scene, is it kind of a learned behavior, as you're saying, that everyone kind of looks up to you? So when you don't get that reaction, it's kind of like, what the fuck?
I don't know. See, I don't believe in that. See, I don't see it as like I'm famous. I don't see it as any of that stuff. It still shocks me.
You're not famous. You're iconic.
Yeah.
It's a level above, brother.
It still shocks me that the level of people recognizing me. I go places like, and I'm like, oh, oblivious to it. I've always have been because I come from a place of always feeling second best, never good enough for myself. So, you know, when I was growing up, all my friends were superstars, super fucking stars.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like George Michael, Boy George, all of them at that point in time were the biggest stars on the planet. And I was always the mate. Even though I was a DJ and I was a very successful DJ at that point, and I was flying on Concorde, that all came second best because I always felt that I was less than them being the pop star. I was always the friend.
So is that kind of where the imposter syndrome comes from? Is actually because you were surrounded by so many brilliant, successful people.
Yeah.
You kind of always felt like the leftovers.
Yeah, and you know, even with my other friends like Kate Moss and you know, I was always Kate Moss's mate. And it's like, you know what, I was always someone's mate to a certain level. And then when I kind of got to this point in my life where I was really honest and I wrote that book, my life changed dramatically, because I then suddenly was, instead of like blocking all of that kind of fame stuff out, or that recognition, self-recognition of who I am as a DJ and what I've achieved, as far as I was concerned up to that point, I hadn't achieved anything.
Really?
It was so bizarre. So that the ego of like, how dare you treat me that way, came in much later. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm gold on British Airways. How dare you not let me on the plane first?
Yeah.
All that rubbish. Do you know what I'm saying to you?
So would you say, you know, writing the book is you finally kind of accepting who you are, and from that point knowing, are you proud of what you've achieved?
I'm so proud of what I've
achieved. So previously you wouldn't have been, but until you sit and reflect, and now you're like,
oh,
I did
all
of that.
I did it last night, you know, after a day of like, I was at home, I had a day at home with Rini the dog, and I popped into town quickly, and then I came back, and then I went into a wormhole of reading stuff on Instagram, and I just was like, and you know what? I sat and I was on Instagram, and I sat and I watched George Michael videos, I watched Prince, I watched so many incredible people from like that, just the music, just, and it just made me feel so happy about where I am in life.
Are you looking for a Columbus car dealership built on tradition and trust? Buyers Auto, family-owned since 1897, offers top new and pre-owned vehicles. Visit us or shop online at buyersauto.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
That's such a beautiful, you know, thing to say. And we talk a lot about on this, podcast about... being happy, and you know, I've said it numerous times on this, part of me, the reason for doing this is because a few years ago, I mean, I never spoke about anything. I didn't ever talk about feelings or any of that sort of stuff. And since then, it's been kind of a journey of trying to find peace of mind and a bit of happiness. And I'm not there. I'm sad the majority of the time. Hearing someone say, I'm finally happy, amazing thing to hear.
Because you know what, Pete, like, I've gone through life never being with one person.
Mm.
I've never, ever in my life been with one person. I'm meant to be. Mm. I've been in long-term relationships, but I've never been with that person.
Yeah.
I've always been, I was always looking over their shoulder for something else. You know, sex addiction and addiction. One is too many and a thousand is never enough. And for me, I was never in a place where I wanted everybody to like me.
Mm.
I went through life wanting, just like me, that's all I want. I never ever wanted anyone to love me, because they would have to find out the real me, and I didn't know who the real me was.
Mm.
And then when I met my husband, right?
Because you married last year.
Yeah, I got married last year.
You've just come back from your honeymoon, haven't you?
Yeah, we had to wait until January for a honeymoon because life was so busy.
Fucking amazing, man.
Yeah, I met him 12 years prior to that. Right, I was living in Hampstead at George's house, and in the biggest sex addiction. Literally, it was like, and the rule was no, I was not allowed to bring men into the house or anyone into the house, because it was his mansion. He was living, I was very blessed to be in that situation. But of course, I turned it into Sainsbury's. There was like coming and going all day long, and I've been chatting to Stavia on some ye olde gay app, God knows what it was, like Gaydar or something. And I was chatting to him. Anyway, I arranged to meet him, and he came to meet me. As I was leaving to go meet him at Hampstead Tube, George walks in. I'm back. And I was like, oh, hi. Anyway, I went off to meet Stavros at the Tube station. And I was like, oh, listen, I was really, even bearing in mind he traveled like 2 hours to get to meet me. I was like, I'm really sorry you can't come to the house. So he's like, but yeah. And anyway, so in the end, I said, oh, I know a really good bush on the heath. So off we trotted to the heath. I always thought it was the middle of June, but he seems to think it was bonfire night because there were fireworks going up.
There's a big difference, mate.
No, it's because the sex was so good. That's why you imagine fireworks.
Nice. But I like it.
Anyway, the next day I said to him, I rang him and I was like, would you like to go out for dinner with me? And he said, no. And I said, well, you know what? Go fuck yourself. And that was it. And didn't see him for 10 years, right? 10 years. Then he comes in, someone, we start chatting, and he came into my life right at the point where my life was hell. I'd got to a point where I was in the most abusive relationship. I was self-abusing. It was awful. I was in such a dark place. And he came and he was this like little flickering light in the corner. And I was having trauma therapy at the time. My trauma therapist was like, no, don't bring a third party into this. Stop now, what are you doing? You know, you're gonna ruin this person's life. And I was like, yeah, maybe you're right. Anyway, so that kind of become a booty call type situation. And then lockdown happened. And I was like, I'm going to Ibiza at the weekend to stay in a hotel that's shut. Do you want to come with me? And that, so up to this point, we'd never slept in the same bed. Mm-hmm. It'd come and keep the cab waiting and go back home. Do you get what I mean? Yeah, it's like one of those situations. And he came to Ibiza with me. And from that moment on, he just changed my life. I realized that I could love myself, and I realized that I was lovable and that I was worth it. And, you know, then the book came out at the same time. And, you know, I wanted that book back. When I wrote that book, it took me 2.5 years because it was never truthful enough. And I kept changing.
Because you kept giving bits. Oh my God.
The book that it started off was like the Argos catalog compared to what it came out like. Literally, it's like what I want. It was like, you know, literally ticks next to everything. And then, and you know, like if you had an underwear section, that would have been stuck together. That was what that book was like, right? And then it kept changing and changing because it wasn't honest. My truth at the time was my truth, how I saw it. It wasn't necessarily the truth. Mm. And as the book panned on, the more and more honest it got, and the more I found subjects that I thought I'd dealt with, I'd never even looked at.
Did you find it quite cathartic doing it? Because it made you look back and reflect. Life-changing. Because, I mean, that's kind of a lot of the problem with a lot of men. Again, it's not necessarily down to a gender, but I think men, it's really common, is that we're so focused on getting somewhere that you never really worry about how you're getting there, and you certainly never look in the fucking rearview mirror.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And work out why you feel these kind of certain ways. We can't express or understand. We don't have the words to say how we feel. So it just comes out in that moment and then you move on.
Yeah.
You don't really think about what made me feel that way.
You plow. I call it plowing. We go like this and everything goes to the side. We don't deal with it. But because we've moved on from it.
Because I'm still going forward. It's all about, all as a man, go forward, move forward, move 100%. Forward.
100%. And then, but that's a point in your life. All that stuff at the side is going to build up and it's going to come in on top of you and bury you. And that's what happens. That's when we have breakdowns. We have emotional breakdowns. We have all of these.
When it consumes you.
100%.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
You take that stuff with you to every relationship.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's every relationship. Yeah, literally dragging like 6 caravan loads of dog shit behind you into the relationship and expecting people to accept it.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the way you talk about Stavros and the place you're in now. Like, genuine, it's like your whole story is fucking fascinating. I said this to you. But resilience of kind of, you know, recovery, everything. To sit and listen to you sit and say that you're happy and like you finally love yourself and you found someone to love you is such a fucking beautiful
You know what
thing.
It is? It's because I don't have any skeletons in the closet. I don't have anything that I'm ashamed of.
Yeah.
All the shame I'm really vocal and open about. And that's freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom. And I'm not seeing you like, oh, what a smug bastard. No, it's taken me 55 years to find that freedom.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that I'm lovable and can be with one person and wants to be with one person, because I feel that everything I have is enough.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? And when I wrote that book, I never thought anyone was going to read it. I never thought it was going to be suddenly a Sunday Times bestseller or any of that stuff. And I, let alone them making a film of it and all of these things. And it was always beyond my dreams. I thought, oh, if a couple of hundred people read it, I'll be well happy if it changes one person's life. And
well, I mean, that's exactly it. It's you know, you've fully changed people's lives, because a lot of it is about people not feeling alone, and people, you know, the feelings that you've had, other people will be feeling at the, you know, at a different point in their life. And actually to see someone come out the kind of the end of that is fucking amazing. But also someone that would admit that you're still a work in progress. We all are.
My God.
Until the fucking day you
die.
Trust me,
literally every day, you know, as long as 60% of that day is on track, the other 40 we won't talk about. Do you get what I'm saying to you?
It's what, you know, I had a book out similarly a couple of years ago that I did for the same reason, called Never Enough.
Yeah.
And again, I didn't think anyone would fucking read it. And then, you know, it becomes Sunday Times. It's mental, isn't it? The amount of messages and how overwhelming it was for people going, do you know what? All I needed to hear was I ain't on me fucking own.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful thing.
It's, you know what? That's the magic of it.
Yeah.
That's the magic of being honest. Because people don't write honest books. People find it really hard to be honest, to say, look, you know.
Yes. It's a fear of judgment.
Yeah, I am a cunt, and I admit that. And my book was, you know, for me, it's a book about redemption, of like turning that factor around, of everything that I had shame about, by putting it into one place and letting people read it. I thought people were going to throw bricks at me. I was so, literally, I rang my publisher the day after I handed it and said, I need the book back. She went, absolutely not. And I was like, why? And she was like, because it's a remarkable thing. And I was like, I don't understand. I said, look, I don't want people hating me. I used to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and think, what have you done? Why have you just ruined your life again? Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I did it on Sunday. I thought, why did you open your mouth this time? Do you know what I mean? Because I was doing the right thing. And it's like, there's a certain level of that. Like it seeps in. And with the new book, it's about, the new book's a self-help book for other people. It's not about me. The stories in there are about me that change it. But what I've done is I've brought in my trauma therapist, right? And she writes the sub-chapters without me even knowing what she's writing.
So it's kind of your experience, and then actually it's from her point of view.
And then she's doing the professional psychological review of that last past chapter.
Wow.
And I've got them, but I've not read them, and I don't want to read them. I don't need to, because... You know, that's the magic of it. Because it's like a therapy book. It's like, okay, I've read this story, I understand. But then she breaks it down and to reasons why I act like that.
But also, I think it's the same, you know, it's the same as if you fucking watch yourself on telly, or you fucking do whatever else. I've never done it because you're self-edit.
Oh, listen.
No one will pick you apart more than you'll fucking pick yourself
apart. Hello. I'm booked in to have my earlobes cut off next week because someone commented, oh my God, how big are his earlobes? And you know what? They know full well that's my Achilles heel. Ever since a kid, I've always hated my earlobes. And now I'm having an earlobe reduction in a couple of weeks' time. But I'm really happy about it.
Good.
Do you know what I mean? Like, literally, it's like, am I having a facelift? No, I'll have an earlobe reduction.
Well, listen, mate, you look fucking great. And I'm so pleased you came on today. There's a couple of little questions that I want to know before we finish. Where you are now in your life, what would you tell your younger self when you were in the kind of midst of addiction and self-loathing?
Shut the fuck up and listen. Because, you know, people tell you things and say things to you. Not the whole world's not out to get you. Do you know what I mean? Don't paint people by your own standards. Don't judge people by your own standards. Don't paint the same scenario that you've painted for yourself onto other people. You know, people for a long time were telling me where I was going wrong. And I'd be like, oh, shut the fuck up. Do you know what I mean? You're just jealous because I, you know, and I used to literally go around telling people, like, I had no teeth. And I was, at one point, I was homeless and people would be like, look at the state. You know, I'd be like, do you know how much it costs to look like this? And like thinking that was the clever answer.
Yeah.
But like never took on board what anyone who showed me love and compassion. I took it always as a stab in the back. And so I would say to that young Tony, literally just breathe and listen, man. Shut up.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's enough going on in here shouting, let alone you transferring it onto other people.
I love that, man. And lastly, Do you have any regrets?
So,
because it's always an interesting one, because everyone says you shouldn't have regrets. I've got a lot.
I've got millions of regrets. Yeah. Of course, I have. Do I regret? You know, I when I wrote that book, I started it with I don't have any regrets. And at the end of the book, I'm like, oh my god,
every line. Page is a fucking regret.
Literally, yeah. And you know what? Of course. You know, but I don't have, it's not about self goals or self esteem. No, I regret I didn't do that. I regret how I treated myself. I regret because how I treat myself, I treat other people. So those
behavior
regrets,
breeds behavior, doesn't
totally.
It?
And you know what? Hurt people hurt, right? And that's it. And you know, so yes, I have lots and lots and lots of regrets, you know, and it's not the superficial ones of like, oh, why did I just eat that whole pizza? Or why am I drinking Coca-Cola again? Do you know what I mean? It gets to the point where it's just like, I just think, I wish I could have changed that time, but I can't. It's about acceptance now.
Love that. Tony, thank you so
much. I love you. Brother. Thank you.
Mate, what a guy. Thank you so much for listening to this ep of Man Made. And you can actually go to Fat Tony's Full Fat Brunch, which is across London. There's dates up until April. It's like a sober rave and it sounds magnificent. So make sure you get some tickets for that. Make sure you rate, review, do all of the stuff you normally do on podcasts. You know how to do that by now. And we will be back with another episode next week.